Go to give to WBAI.org. And pledge $10 a month for the next 12 months. Not only does that make the fundraising end sooner, if enough of you do it, maybe you wouldn't need to have as many fundraising drives at all. Maybe no one will try again to take the station over lock, stock, and transmitter. Because many people making small monthly donations over a whole year means that BAI would have a solid and predictable base of support. So yeah, BAI buddies are the gift that keeps on giving. $10 a month for the next 12 months. Become a BAI buddy. Go to give to WBAI.org. That's give, the number 2, WBAI.org. There will always be some people who take but don't give. But you don't want to be one of those people, right? Give to WBAI.org $12 a month for the next 12 months. And maybe someday programs will be 100% program. 0% pitching. Give to WBAI.org. Become a BAI buddy.
Hey, this is Michael, a BAI buddy from Brooklyn. WBAI, oh WBAI, you're listening to WBAI. 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Listen and learn. And become a BAI buddy today.
And you are indeed, in case you couldn't have told, tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, intermittently, Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf if the host can get his act together. Is it possible? Well, possible, yes. Likely? Another question altogether. Just bear with us. Okay, well, the theme music seems to have disappeared. So, just bear with... No. There it is. What have disappeared are my eyes. So, on that note, let's start the theme music, shall we? We'll be right back. good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning with us is John Ordover, a person of many, manies, and, well, we're going to be discussing a lot of things, including largely media. Stay tuned. Good morning.
I'm Dan Persis.
Dan, wait. Oh, he's on recording. Wait anyway. Okay. Dan Persis' review, first one we're hearing in like 7 weeks, is very relevant to this morning's show. Now, it's this morning. It's in New York. It's a little after 1 a.m. If you're listening in California, it's a different time. But so it goes. And I originally did have a guest from Massachusetts, in fact, going to be here today. But things have been so crazy, what with the lockout that we have endured and coming back on the air. This is my second and a half show because I was on the air from 1 till 5 a.m., as basically the first semi-show. There was a one-hour celebration first. And then Ken Gale, Fran Luck, and I were on from 1 to 5, taking phone calls and stuff. So last week was really the first show. And it was mostly a pitching show with some material. This week will be material show with some pitching. And John Ordover wrote me, frequent guest, wrote me yesterday and asked if I wanted to see him do comedy. And he actually meant in a club, because I've seen him, well, act out many times before. but this was a more professional thing, about which we'll be hearing a great deal in a little while. And by coincidence, I have a ritual when I have a guest. First of all, as I was saying, I had a guest from Massachusetts. She had to postpone, which was okay by me because things are just too chaotic in my life right now. And then John wrote me and asked if I wanted to see his act, which began at 8 o'clock. And it's right here. I mean, it's a block and a half away. It's an Atlantic Avenue block and a half, which is sort of like in Manhattan, where you have these really, really long stretches between avenues, like between Columbus and Amsterdam is 3 miles. It's sort of like that. So in all seriousness, from here to the next block up at the end of Atlantic Avenue it's a block and a half, actually. It's, I would say, about a little more than a quarter mile.
Yeah, the avenue blocks are
The street blocks are 20 to a mile, and the avenue blocks are 5 or 10 to a mile in Manhattan.
But I'm talking about, by comparison. I'm talking about here. So the point is that, but he needed to paper the house. You know, he needs bodies to go see a performance. There's nothing. Well, we'll get into that. Like, what does it take for a comedian in an empty house, and what must that feel like? And I've never been a stand-up comic professionally, as it were, but I know the feeling of being somewhere, and out in the audience are just crickets. None named Freddie. We'll get into that a little later as well. But the and I think we will play Train of Thought.
Okay.
Because there's a science fictional tie-in that I think I've told you before. At any rate, Dan Persons has gotten back on the reviewing thing as usual, and he has reviewed a streaming show which I've watched, which John has watched, and which I think of the three of us, we have about four opinions. John says five. And the and John always has interesting opinions. I don't always agree, but always has interesting opinions on media, science fiction of various kinds. And so I thought that I would introduce John, introduce the show, and now play Dan's review. And then we can all have a what do they call it in football when everybody jumps to get the ball, scramble?
Are you talking about a scrum in rugby?
No. We could liken it to a scrum in rugby. I have known what that is for almost a week and a half now. Because I learned about a scrum on Safari Live, my favorite TV show, and which is rebranding itself back to Wild Earth. And they were very, very into talking about rugby because South Africa won the World Cup this year. And so they were just, like, overjoyed. It's like, you know, who cares about the leopards and elephants and all that, you know? You know, we won the World Cup. So at any rate, yeah, call it like a scrum in rugby. That will do. I think there is a term in football.
There may well be, but you are looking at the entirely wrong person to provide that information.
As am I. So, at any rate, let us hear Dan's review of The Mandalorian. And for those who don't know, just a little bit of background, there is a new streaming service called Disney Plus. I don't know who's running it, but it's called Disney Plus. And I became a charter subscriber, which is to say about 4 months ago they had a deal that if you were, it's rather, for compared to the other streaming services, it's half price. And if you subscribed for 3 years for like a 2 week period 4 months ago, you got half their price. And knowing what they carry and knowing what they will be carrying at, you know, under $4 a month, I said, hell yeah. And I subscribed, and I'm not sorry for it. But the thing that they are, you know, aside from archives, they have a couple of new shows. One with Jeff Goldblum that I really, well, it's got issues, but I really enjoy it. And it's actually part of their National Geographic section. They have five sections. Star Wars, Pixar, Marvel, National Geographic, and
Or Dover.
And there's another. And the I mean, they own the Muppets. They own a great deal of stuff, clearly. But at any rate, thank you, Max. At any rate, the thing that they're spending their money on, no doubt this is a loss leader. They're not going to make money at this. But the idea was to have original Star Wars material that would be somewhere between the quality of a movie and the Ewok adventure, which I think it qualifies as being between those both, because those are like two extremes.
We'll talk after Dan.
We'll talk after Dan. And I think from Dan we will hear one extreme, from John another, and I will be somewhere in the middle, as is often the case. So, at this point, welcome back to the program, Daniel Persons.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review.
He's got it branded differently.
30 seconds into the first live-action TV series set in the Star Wars universe, The Mandalorian, a door dilates. Maybe that means nothing to you, but since the focus of Hour of the Wolf is largely literary science fiction, I'm guessing you recognize that that phrase, the door dilated, is frequently cited as something that can only be understood within the context of a science fiction story. It's credited originally to Robert Heinlein, and Samuel Delaney is most famous for having referenced it, although he says Harlan Ellison got there first. But the fact that it figures in this TV show raises an interesting question. I haven't seen the script for the first episode of The Mandalorian where this happens, but I'm strongly convinced that writer Jon Favreau, who also co-produces the series, wrote that exact phrase, "the door dilates." If he did, it gives us an insight into where he's coming from, and it turns out to be a place with a greater understanding of science fiction than I would have thought, and maybe what he's hoping to do with this series. It must be said that the first two episodes of The Mandalorian are beautiful. They'd have to be. Disney is betting the moisture farm on their new streaming service, Disney Plus, and The Mandalorian is meant to be the killer app that's going to tempt anyone who doesn't have five-year-olds at home to pony up $7 a month for the privilege. Director Dave Filoni, who actually comes out of animation, he worked on Avatar, The Last Airbender, and Star Wars Rebels, among others, and also produces, puts all the money up on the screen, creating an amazingly lush, lively, and detailed universe, at least as palpable, and maybe more, than the feature films. As for the story, we're only two shows into a season-long arc, so what we've got to judge on is mostly atmosphere and the beats that are contained within each episode. But at least each episode feels like a self-contained adventure, which is good. It's obvious Favreau is leaning heavily on the influence of Sergio Leone's spaghetti westerns for the series' overall outlook. An easy enough reach, given that the show focuses on a hardened bounty hunter played by Pedro Pascal, who never removes his helmet or body armor. But that's a bit of a problem, since we're tasked with identifying with a lead character who doesn't give us much in terms of body language, and whose dialogue, along with the dialogue of the series overall, is pretty damn colorless. Surprising, since this is coming from the guy who wrote Swingers. If you're going to make your protagonist that laconic, you've got to give us at least a face to look at. What Favreau is relying on mostly is exciting action sequences, which Filoni skillfully delivers in abundance, and tons of inside references to trip those Star Wars endorphins. Jawas and Ugnaughts show up. There are fleeting glances of Kowakian monkey lizards roasting on spits, and good for them, they deserve it. And even a passing invocation of Life Day, because I guess Favreau was feeling especially mischievous at that moment. What I'm saying is that if your beef with the new Disney Star Wars features was that they leaned too heavily on fond memories of the original trilogy, you will probably be just as annoyed, if not outright incensed, by The Mandalorian. If you can set that aside, though, these first two episodes, flat dialogue notwithstanding, are pretty damn entertaining. The balancing of practical and computer-generated effects is well considered, and the main setup, which appears to center around the Mandalorian, nobody has names in this, by the way, at least not yet, but it involves the Mandalorian retrieving and protecting a baby Yoda, Sorry, I checked. Turns out Yoda has no established species to describe him. The character here looks downright kittenish, though. Some clever work from the animatronics guys. Anyway, the main setup holds promise. Following suit with CBS All Access, Disney is releasing these episodes on a weekly basis, so if you're motivated enough to follow along, you're pretty much committed to 2 months' worth of fees. I guess I'm in for the duration. The Mandalorian looks like it's going to be fun. More fun than Discovery ever was. And who knows, maybe he'll take off that helmet eventually. Seriously, Jon Favreau, consider it. It'll help, trust me. And Pedro Pascal will thank you. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Sorry, I was fetching water. Okay, so Dan really, 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 really likes the show. Before John chimes in, because he has an alternate opinion, I have an alternate opinion as well. I really liked the look of the first episode. It made me feel like I was back in the Star Wars verse. It was dropping shout outs. I don't like to use the idiotic phrase Easter egg. I love Easter eggs. What people call Easter eggs aren't Easter eggs. An Easter egg is something that you really, really, really have to hunt for. And it's not simply a wink, wink shout out to something else. But so it does a lot of shout outs. It has, you know, known species of creatures that you haven't seen since the cantina scene, since the first movie. And it uses recognizable characters of types, I should say, character types and stuff that the movie series does. And in that sense, Favreau has sort of pulled, I think, a J.J. Abrams, which is to say, not lots of meat, but what's there is churse. Although I felt that the first episode that ran 40 minutes could very well have been trimmed by 10 and be better for that trimming. And I think that the second episode, which runs 31 minutes, could have been trimmed by 30. And have been much better. I thought that the second episode, while still nice to look at, had absolutely no story point to it. And it had like one action scene that sort of worked, but when it was over, nothing was different than it was in the first. And before John has a say, I will say my favorite thing in the first episode, which I thought was rather brilliant, was a fighting droid, a bounty hunter droid, that the lead character, the Mandalorian, a nameless Mandalorian, had at first a fight with, and then a shared battle with, and then a spoiler with. Don't want to give it away, you might watch it. And it may or may not surprise you. Won't surprise you if you've watched Sergio Leone movies. The whole series is very much based, if Sergio Leone were to direct a Star Wars film,
the music would be better.
The music wasn't bad. It didn't bother me. No, it wasn't Michael Giacchino who did the music.
No idea.
Somebody major. Somebody good. At any rate. And somehow I don't think that Ennio Morricone is quite right for Star Wars. But at any rate, I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to the third episode. I hope that it will be better than the second episode. It is nice to look at. There's no two ways about it. You feel like you're back on Tatooine or something along those lines. And as far as the content is concerned, they're having a lot of fun with the casting. The person, the client who hires the bounty hunter is played by Werner Herzog, which is a little bit weird. No, not a little bit weird. It's very, very weird. But Herzog is quite a character himself. And he killed Zac Efron in a movie.
Well, you know, you got to like him for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever seen Herzog's movie about the Loch Ness Monster?
No.
I'm blanking on the name of it. But basically, he plays Werner Herzog, a movie director who's hired by an exobiologist. And there are a couple on board, and they go on the... everybody knows that the Loch Ness Monster is a hoax. But in fact, it's killing off the crew members one by one, including the exobiologist, and one of whom is not Zac Efron. It's who's the fellow who produced a number of Marvel, wrote minor things like Iron Man, Zach something. Well, one way or the other,
Snyder.
That, no, Marvel, not...
I know, that's always a little surprise.
Not that other one, Z-A-C, not Z-A-C-K. So if you can't tell Zis from Zach, never mind. At any rate, I'll IMDb it and come up with
but
it.
But back to the Mandalorian.
Back to Werner Herzog.
Okay.
The point is, it's just a goof of a movie, because he kills off TV all show. These people. It's a movie.
Oh. Okay, we're still talking about the Loch Ness Monster movie.
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I lost track.
I never stopped. You changed the subject. Usually I change the subject on my own. No, I've been talking about that for a while. My point is that he kills off all these people, including this guy, and people are going, oh, yeah, but he kills off this character in the movie. And it's like, yeah, have you noticed that this character that he killed off has written about, you know, five major movies since. I mean, the whole thing is just a freaking goof. It mocks mockumentaries. It's nothing but a practical joke. And I think Werner Herzog's appearance in The Mandalorian, see, I hadn't lost my track, was a similar practical joke. So, in brief, I enjoyed watching it. I think it could have been better.
Could have been better is a wild understatement for me. I will say that what I felt it most had in common with the original 77 Star Wars movie is that...
The title of which is, let's see if you get it right...
Star Wars.
Thank you.
Yes.
Very few people get that correct.
Yes. Is that the droid were the best characters. I mean, that about so far in the two episodes, the bounty droid was the best character.
This is not a very character heavy show
or story heavy. You know, once you take look, if you like things that don't have character or story, you'll love this.
Yeah, but there's not a whole lot of story to Star Wars either.
There's at least Rescue the Princess, and in this case, we don't have that much.
There's Rescue Something. We don't know exactly what it is, and that is going to turn out to be a major plot point.
Well, see, that is a...
Remember, this is a TV series, and that was a movie.
No, I understand, but I have no... nonetheless, your obligation is to make me care in the first episode. And if I don't know what the guy is doing or why he's doing it... It's impossible to care. I mean, are we doing the bounty hunter story where the bounty hunter is sent off after someone and then finds that they actually have a moral code that doesn't allow them to bring this person in?
There's a lot that we don't know. What we do know is that it takes place after, Return of the Jedi, about 5 years after. We know that we don't know the identity of the lead character. And more importantly, I have not yet been able to figure out or decide, and it's perfectly left ambiguous, is the supposedly title character, because who knows, another Mandalorian might turn up. We don't know if this is a good guy or a bad guy. See, that's how enigmatic he is.
Here's the thing.
He's the thing with no name.
There's a difference between intrigue and ignorance. And you have 30 minutes to hook me. And then I'll watch one of the other 5,000 things that are out there for me to watch. So by the end of 30 minutes, I'm not asking to be spoon-fed everything. I'm not asking to have every question answered. I'm not asking to have it all laid out for me. But provide some hook of interest so that I start caring what happens next. If you send a guy out on a mission that I don't
now,
know what
now, didn't
is,
the,
I don't care.
Now, without spoiling it, or if we have to spoil it, we will spoil
right.
it.
Right.
Didn't the very end, the identity of the person that he was bountying, that he was going after to return to Werner Herzog, that didn't intrigue you?
No, it just made me think, how stupid can you possibly be to send a bounty hunter off without the information he needs to recognize what exactly he's there to capture? We're getting this.
He's told you'll know it when you see it. And we do.
But he doesn't. Can I spoil?
Yeah.
Okay. The bottom line is, you're talking about a Yoda species.
It's a baby Yoda.
It's a baby of Yoda species. Okay.
Whatever that is called.
It is a baby of Yoda species that has force powers.
And since we haven't done time travel in Star Wars yet, thank God.
Yeah.
We're assuming it's not baby Yoda.
Right. And there's actually no specific reason to assume that Yoda was the last of his kind, as far as I know.
Actually, there's no... You're right.
Okay. But...
Well, when he does say he's the last, but that could be Jedi teacher.
Right. Exactly. But in any case, I understand it was the fact that it was a surprise to me, I had no problem with. The fact that it was a surprise to the bounty hunter, I had a lot of problem with. Because he says, all they told me was it's 50 years old. They didn't tell me it was a baby. Well, why didn't they? I mean, it just makes them seem stupid for not giving him all the information, and him seem stupid for not asking for it.
I could answer that in the third episode if I were the writer.
But by now I've stopped caring because I think this guy's an idiot who can't ride a creature, and we've just watched him spend 10 minutes trying to falling off the back of a CGI animal.
I think we know by now that Jon Favreau can write.
Yes, but it doesn't...
So he did that for a reason.
Yes, but the obligation to intrigue me continuously is not lifted by the fact that in the past... Other stuff he's done has paid off. I can't think of anything he's done that had no hook in the... bottom line, mostly what he's done is movies, right?
Except for his Chef TV series, yeah.
Yeah. The problem is...
This isn't even his first TV series.
Right, I understand that. But the problem is the obligation in a movie and the obligation in TV are different. Okay, TV is a different medium. It's a different type of storytelling.
Okay. He was primarily tasked, as he always is. He's not hired for his storytelling abilities, really.
Right.
He's hired for being able to create a look and feel and stick within a universe.
And that was done fine. But you also
actually, for Barbara and I, for example, I was less taken with it than she. She loved it the way Dan loves it. And if I and the moment the channel went up on Tuesday, we watched it on Tuesday as everybody else did, and the second episode went up on Friday, and I thought, well, we can watch it. Number of any other things, including the other services we have. We haven't had cable in about a year and a half now, but we're lacking nothing. That's another discussion. But the first thing she wanted to see was episode 2 of The Mandalorian.
And so far,
it does seem to have hooked enough people, John, that she's not alone.
Can I help it if they're all wrong? I mean, no.
There does come a point when you're going to have to say this is your hang-up.
Yes, I am very much a story-focused guy. And if you don't hook me with the story immediately, I'm going to go watch something that does hook me with the story.
Yeah, you and DeCandido are very similar. You like different things. But if somebody... we're talking about Keith R.A. DeCandido.
Right.
But if somebody makes a statement with which he disagrees, his answer is, you're wrong.
Yes.
And you're the same.
Well, that's because he got it from me.
But you know what? You're both wrong.
Well, see, now you got it from us.
And I'm not, yes, but the difference is that I'm right.
Yeah, okay.
You're wrong. No, and the point is, and one has to learn this here at WBAI, there are alternate viewpoints in the world, especially when it comes to art.
Right, but
if you want to call it that. Because it is a commercial, it is the most commercial, I hate to use the word enterprise, but yeah, it's the one that fits, that one can imagine, is the launching of Disney Plus.
And it, you know, I understand it from a marketing point of view. I even, to be honest, I actually do understand why people who are very much into Star Wars might like it. But so far, but I care about story. And so far, it does not really have one. Oh, and there's so many missed.
I mean, if you compare story of The Mandalorian to the story of Episode One, The Phantom Menace, then The Mandalorian is a masterpiece in comparison.
You know, I'd even disagree with that. Once you get past the scroll in The Phantom Menace, there is at least some action and some people doing things for some reason.
The wrong people, and for the wrong reason. It actually doesn't fit into the universe.
You know what? We may have to wait until Weird Al releases his Mandalorian song, but because that was the redeeming feature of
this. Is he actually doing that?
No.
Oh.
But the point being that I'm not saying you don't have to like it because I don't like it, but acknowledge at least that. Well, look, there's some great characterization points that were missed. Just minor ones. Like when...
Sorry, queuing something up.
Oh, okay. I thought you were bleeping me. Okay. Stop. Jim. Stop. No, never mind. I was just doing that on purpose.
Move on, please.
Okay. The point being, like when he brings...
Because we're more than half an hour into the show, we haven't begun pitching, so...
Okay. When he brings the first bounty he collects to get paid for it, and the guy tries to pay him in Empire credits, and he says, there's no Empire now. He says, okay, I'll pay you with this instead. There was a great moment where can only pay you half. And he says, there was a great moment where he could have scooped up both the other form of payment.
Oh, one second. Dan says, love's a strong word. I think it has merits.
Okay. he could have scooped up both the alternate form of payment, whatever it was, I've forgotten it, and the Empire credits, and that would have been funny.
Okay, let's not get into these details.
Okay.
Listeners aren't interested.
Okay.
To be blunt, if you want to talk about the merits of the show versus the demerits, fine.
The droid was great.
The droid was fabulous, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, the droid was fabulous.
It was something not yet seen in the Star Wars world, and yet it fit perfectly.
No, that exact kind of droid was in, I think, Rogue One.
I don't think so.
Well, there was some droid that looked that was exactly in that shape that was...
That wasn't a major character and didn't play a major part.
Right,
in the So maybe he took it from there. But in this, it's a lead character for a while anyway.
Fundamentally, the Mandalorian would not even have succeeded if the Yoda baby didn't use its force powers to save his ass. So by the end of season...
I didn't pick up on that.
The giant beast that was eating him was about to eat him until the Yoda floated it into the air?
Oh, that's that. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So what you've shown me is a character whose motivation I don't understand, who can't ride whatever the horsey kinds of thing was,
Bonto.
And who would have been killed if the baby didn't surprise him with its force powers. And so far, I'm not only have no characterization
for him.
Well,
actually, we don't know that. That's how it was won. We don't know that it would have killed him.
Right. But the point being, they didn't seem to go out of their... They talked a lot about him being competent, but they didn't actually show him being very competent.
But we don't know anything about him, so he's an enigma.
That means that every little piece that we do see of him is important character information. We know that he looks like an idiot falling off a CGI animal.
Mm-hmm.
We know that it didn't look like he was going to win unless somebody else saved his butt.
Okay, so there is comedy about the character.
Right, but since we have known nothing else about the character, it makes him start to look like he can't get the job done. And
maybe he can't. You don't know that. You don't know that that isn't the point.
That's true, but
that's my point.
Okay, but they do talk about him as being the best of the best.
I don't recall anybody saying
that. Oh, yeah,
they
said, well, I don't...
No, they said Mandalorians are the best at this. They didn't say that one was. They don't know who he is.
Right.
That's the point. They don't know who he is, and...
It could be someone pretending to be a Mandalorian.
We don't know. But they do know he never takes off the mask. He never takes off the uniform. I have a guess as to his identity, which is a spoiler right there. It's only a spoiler as to what my guess is, because there's only one Mandalorian we have ever met in the Star Wars universe, although I haven't read all the books. And for listeners, John Ordover is a bit of expert at what they do in novelizations of universes, because you were the steward of the Star Trek
For
over a decade, right.
Yeah, but the thing is, the Star Wars has actively thrown out everything that wasn't in the movies or TV shows.
Yes, right.
So, you know, the
But in this case, he is working with the producers.
Right. This will tie in to the TV shows and movies, but there will be nothing in the books that...
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. At any rate, let's get off this.
Okay.
Because you're getting mired down in details that are of no interest to the listeners, frankly. Unless they've actually seen it, and
right.
I would venture under 2% of our listeners have seen this. So the question, the point of review is it worth your while watching it or not? For John, he didn't like it. It was not because it failed to meet his criteria. It met my criteria. It met Barbara's. It met Dan's. Dan and Barbara more or less agreed. I disagree. I think that the second episode was not just weak, I think it was non-existent. It didn't even have new special effects to draw me in any further. I was really, honestly, very surprised at that, because there is so much money up in that screen. This show is reputed to have a $50 million an episode budget. John, you wrote with David Mack, you wrote two Star Trek episodes.
Correct.
What was the budget on those?
Well,
roughly.
Fortunately, that wasn't our problem.
It's not but my question.
At that time, the budget for a random Star Trek episode was $500,000 to
sell. That much?
Yeah, about then. About that, give or take.
I'm surprised it was that high.
Ours were probably significantly less.
Because you did one set.
Not entirely one set, but we have found it very effective to pitch TV shows with the cheapest thing we can possibly think of to produce.
Okay, Dan is having a whole other conversation on Facebook. Mandalorians figure prominently in Star Wars Rebels. Aha! Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay, so there are... You see, so outside of the movies, there is a great deal of Mandalorian fic.
Dan, is Star Trek Rebels a game or what?
It's a TV series.
TV series, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
There are about five different Star Wars TV shows, you know.
Well, all I can say is what I've said, which is that...
All post-Ewok, thank God.
I love the Ewoks.
The Ewok Adventure?
No. But I like
that. That's what I was referring
to. But the bottom line is, I need to be intrigued. I have a low attention span.
John, you said this.
Okay, I did.
Okay, so let's move on.
Okay.
As I said earlier. And let me, and yes, animated series. That's what I said.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and by the way, if you'd like to talk to Dan Persons about all this, right now he's on Facebook on the WBAI radio page, the Hour of the Wolf page, and on my timeline under Jim Freund. I am not paying a lot of attention to that because I have learned that if I focus on the video Facebook Live aspect of this event, then I'm not focusing on the radio.
Okay.
And it's, you know, how can you be in two places at once when you're not anywhere
at all? Yes.
Anywhere at all. So, and I do want to move on to some other things. And Dan, as long as I can see you, and you can type in very briefly, are you at all interested in being a voice on the air, or do you want to just type on Facebook? Nod once for yes, blink twice for no, or else type it into Facebook Live and let me know, because I could use the phone system to dial out. I can't. I think. Because I'm using my phone, which has your phone number on it, to do the Facebook Live. Although I can probably log in and find it elsewhere. At any rate, so I thought that we would continue with some of the new things and some of the media things, including some movies, not all of which are science fiction.
They still make movies that aren't science fiction?
They make non-science fiction movies by science fiction writers.
Okay.
One of which I thought was exceptionally good but got mediocre reviews. And that is, now I'm Motherless Brooklyn, which I thought was the best noir film since Chinatown.
I have not seen it.
No, it only recently opened.
Yeah.
But it, I actually went to a preview, and which also the preview itself was extremely cool because it was in the screening room at in the Warner Brothers HBO new complex, hasn't been open 3 months, in the Hudson Yards, and it's exceedingly high tech, and I've never been in a spiffier screening room, and they tend to be pretty darn spiffy. But I also thought that the movie, which is written, directed, and starring Edward Norton, while it doesn't pay a whole lot of attention to the novel by Jonathan Lethem, it was approved by Jonathan Lethem. And as I say, it has a few drawbacks. It has a few things that I would nit. But it was, as I say, really great neo-noir. The other thing that I saw, as a matter of fact, I saw last night, was Jojo Rabbit, which is made by people who I would argue is a fantasy film, because it bears, even though it is set in Nazi Germany, it is directed by a fellow who's directed Marvel movies and What We Do in the Shadows, which is a mockumentary vampire movie come TV series, since the movie was set in New Zealand, the TV series in Staten Island. I enjoy the TV series, but I liked the movie a lot more. I thought it ran a little long. And he's done a number of other movies, not to mention Thor Ragnarok, which maybe, arguably, the best of the Thor movies, because it's the first one that actually feels like a damned comic book instead of a self-important Marvel movie. And for that alone, it got a lot of credit with me. So, and it too has its problems, one of which is, and that I think Scarlett Johansson, who's wonderful in the film, I think she's very miscast.
Oh, in Motherless Brooklyn, not in...
No, not in Motherless Brooklyn. She's not in Motherless Brooklyn. I said Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Directed and written by Taika Waititi.
Got it.
Stay with us here. I was talking about recent releases from people that are not science fiction, done by people that normally do science fiction.
Got it.
And Jojo Rabbit... Well, it's a fantasy film in a way because, well, it's largely about a boy's fantasies and all that. It's another one of those films that's a comedy where the Nazis are among the comic figures, including the director, writer, playing an imaginary friend, which is Adolf Hitler, and Sam Rockwell as a bumbling wannabe stormtrooper, and Rebel Wilson as basically sort of a Valkyrie. I think her purpose in the film is pointless. But it's... The whole movie made me very nervous throughout. I was unnerved by the film, which... I am sure is exactly what they wanted. And not to mention the fact that my Jewish parents grew up respectively in Nuremberg and Frankfurt. My mother also, between Frankfurt and Prague, much of the movie was shot in Prague. And so there was a very personal connection. To an extent, I tend to avoid Holocaust movies and books and things for just that reason, being the son of two Holocaust survivors. It cuts a little close. But nevertheless, it's a really good movie. And I heartily recommend it. But there are issues with it. There is so much out there right now because we're in the holiday season with new streaming services on the horizon. I do not... Are you a CBS All Access subscriber?
I am.
You are. The thing that I'm more in... I'm not that interested, I have to say, in Discovery. The first two episodes didn't draw me in, but what does interest me is the Twilight Zone.
Well... first of all, if you just skip the entire first season of Discovery and jump in with the first episode of the second season, it's incredibly involving. And what's particularly hilarious is you can see them going through episode by episode and undoing everything that was stupid about the first season, actively undoing it. It's like, this episode, we're going to toss out this line that undoes this bit of stupidity. This episode, we're going to have the whole story undo this piece of stupidity.
But that sounds like they're backtracking.
They're not.
Stupidity.
They're not. They're just, they sort of either good plots or throwaway lines. Like they, in the first season, they established they traveled the galaxy on
the
fungus.
The quadrant, it would have to be.
No, it's the universe, in fact, in Discovery.
In Discovery, really?
It's the universe, and it could blip from any place in the galaxy to any place else in the galaxy through a myocystian network, which is basically fungus, some sort of ephemeral space fungus. I'm not making that up. And in the first episode...
I didn't think you were, and this is more of the reason why I don't know that this is
but
my...
But in the first episode of the second season, Captain Pike takes command of the Discovery.
Right, this I know.
And one of the first things they start explaining the new, they call it zip drive, that lets them pop.
Really?
No, I'm calling it that.
Oh.
Okay, that lets it pop from one
place. I used to have a zip drive.
Yeah, I know. The pop from one place to another. And they start explaining it to the captain. He said, look, if you're going to tell me that we can get from any place in space to any place in any place else in space using a system that's based on mushrooms, I'm just going to take your word for it. Never explain it. And they drop it.
Okay, but I have news for you.
Yeah.
It is very possible for me to go from one place in space to another
on mushrooms. Yes, I understand.
And I have done it on the air.
Yes.
But that's another story.
Yes.
I shouldn't tell on the air too often.
Right.
But at any rate,
yes,
I think it is time for us to pitch a little.
Okay.
And remind people that we are in a fund drive. We shouldn't be, we wouldn't be, except for the fact that, as no doubt people know, we were taken off the air by a rogue faction within our ownership that illegally, against the voting block of the Pacifica Foundation, were owned by the Pacifica Foundation, against eight people out of some 20-something, took it upon themselves to shut WBAI down, even though in a vote they once tied and then were vastly outnumbered not to do it. And when directed by Pacifica to put us back on the air, they refused. And it took a court order to bring us back on the air November 7th. And this rogue faction said, oh, this doesn't matter. We're working on changing the bylaws to put us in charge of Pacifica anyway. At which point, the now re-legitimatized Pacifica board basically said, oh, yes, and by the way, we're not funding your lawyers anymore. So any actions that they would take, further actions, to try to do more damage, the lawyers wouldn't be funded. So it's a complicated thing, but what happened was we were in the beginning of one of our more successful fundraising drives when they took us off. The claim that they took us off was because we were costing too much. So at a point when we're actually not just making money, but making more money than the other stations were in fundraising, they took us off the air. We now have to make up the money that we would have made in October. And furthermore, we have to make up the cost of the legal actions that were taken. And if you ask who can we sue, the answer is, well, it was our owners or a faction of our owners that used our own money to do it. There is nobody we can sue. We can't sue ourselves. We can't sue the Pacifica Foundation. We are the Pacifica Foundation. So what we have to do is we have to turn to our sponsors and say, sponsor us. And since we are listener-sponsored, we have to find those few people. There was a lot of newspaper coverage, a huge amount of newspaper coverage that talked about our going off the air, and very, very little coverage, especially in comparison, that said that we're back on. It can be assumed that we have only a fraction of the listenership, which had gone from being very strong listenership to being a very weak listenership in this new millennium. And the station has been rebuilding itself in terms of programming, and as is the concept of listener-sponsored radio, the money started finally coming in as the programming got better. That is the idea behind listener-sponsored radio. If you build it, they will come. And some people were discovering the programming was getting better. And now all that is lost. So it is up to us to ask you to support the radio station. Now, usually we just ask for donations. But right now, we are focusing, hyper-focusing, on the concept of the WBAI buddy. And what the buddy means is it's sort of like our equivalent of a Patreon account. It means that you are signing up to give a certain amount of money per month. You're becoming a patron. The management is really stressing $25 a month buddies. I'm saying give $10 a month, please. And don't just donate $120. There are advantages, several advantages to us if you do it this way, the $10 a month buddy. Not that we would turn down a $25. You can go right up to $500. You can just about name your own amount. We would prefer it to be at, you know, starting at the $10 level. But we won't turn down less. And the way that you do that is either you go online to WBAI.org and you click there and it says, you can give money here or something along those lines. I don't remember exactly what it is, but I do like to, you know, everybody saying, go, you have to go to give to WBAI. And then they say the number two. No, you don't. Number one, you don't have to use a number two. You can type in TO. And it will take you to the same place. Number two, if you just go to the much easier to remember, WBAI.org, there's one extra click that will take you to the same place. So go to WBAI.org and become a BAI buddy. And when it asks you what your favorite program is, well, you know it's Hour of the Wolf, don't you? But it's more important to really be supporting the station. The other thing you can do, because I know that there are some people that really do not wish to do it online for any number of reasons, you can make a phone call to our phone service, which is located at 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. And either pledge your support, pledge an amount of money, or preferably what we are really focusing on as this crisis, which is not over, by the way. We're back on the air, but we're still not only battling the a large faction of the people that own us and the other radio stations that have bought into a great lie, which is that we're costing more money than anybody else. It appears that there are other audits and books to be done that show that we may be making more money than most of the other stations. The whole Pacifica Foundation is... What? I looked at a comment from Dan Persons on Facebook, and I shouldn't have. He says, someone in the Trek Writers Room dropped shrooms. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, the point is we have a lot of recovery to do. We've met the enemy, as Walt Kelly said, and he is us. And I should say, and they is us, would be the 21st century version of that. So again, please make that pledge, make that call to 516-620-3602 or aim your browser at WBAI.org and become a BAI buddy. So why don't we take a musical break?
Okay.
And then I like to do that about once an hour, and it is 2 o'clock in New York City over WBAI New York. And actually, I could have done a legal break by saying it is 2 o'clock in New York City on WBAI. See, the law is very... Their wording is that you have to say the call letters and the location of the transmitter next to each other. They don't say in which order.
Ah.
So it doesn't have to be WBAI New York. It could be New York WBAI. But...
Can I try?
Oh, go for it.
New York, WBAI.
Well, there you go. You even used the same intonation. And on that note, let's play a song which seems appropriate to The Mandalorian.
I met him in a swamp down in Dagobah, where it bubbles all the time like a giant carbonated soda. S-O-D-A, soda. I saw the little runt sitting there on a log. I asked him his name, and in a raspy voice he said, Yoda. Y-O-D-A, Yoda.
Weird Al Yankovic, here over listener-sponsored non-commercial radio, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And I should have probably played that earlier, but it was the only possible song after all of that discussion about that TV series. John is very much enamored with The Watchmen, which I don't watch, man, because I don't get HBO. And if I did, I'd probably have given it a try. But I've looked at the graphic novel. To me, I call it a comic book. And I've seen much of the movie, which left me highly underimpressed.
As it should.
Zack Snyder, you know, despite what Gal Gadot and Ben Affleck are saying, release the Snyder cut. It's like, why?
Yeah.
Why? There's really, I mean, I haven't seen a Zack Snyder DC. When he, you know, the best DC comic movie that I have seen in a long time really was Wonder Woman. And that was Patty Jenkins. And the end of the movie sucks because after having built up this wonderful backstory and the whole thing with Chris Pine and Lucy Snyder and the other characters that are in there, all of a sudden it is revealed, duh, surprise, it wasn't like hidden, that one of the characters who we thought was a good guy is the heavy, the bad guy. And then you spend half an hour of that movie in a very typical close-up, freeze-frame, slow-motion, typical Zack Snyder kind of thing. And basically, that's where Snyder came in and took the movie over. It's like, yeah, thank you, ladies. We'll take it from here. And sort of spoiled what I thought was otherwise a really good superhero movie. Did you like it at all, John?
I liked Wonder Woman quite a lot, except for the part where that you're bringing out that for whatever reason they couldn't find an ending to the movie.
Yes,
and
which is true of all Zack Snyder films.
Well, that's kind of why I tend to avoid Zack Snyder films.
Okay.
Fortunately, yeah. He has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the Watchmen TV show.
I do find myself compelled to watch them, however, just before we get to the HBO series. I don't know why. Is it maybe a sense of responsibility, of hope? I couldn't make it through Aquaman, which is not a Zack Snyder film, is it?
It is not, but I will tell you my reaction to Aquaman.
Yes.
Having finished that movie, I so wanted lobster.
Right.
It made me so hungry for seafood because there were all these wonderfully designed creatures that were intelligent but looked delicious.
Well, there are all these different TV series recently with... I saw one last night. What was it I was watching last night? Oh, second episode of the third season of The Crown, in which Clancy Brown played Lyndon Johnson, and also watching Clancy Brown on the TV series Emergence. And Clancy Brown, of course, is the head of the Krabby Patty Shack where SpongeBob works. So I hear his voice, and he has a great voice, and I just think, Krab Patties.
So, well, you haven't missed anything with Aquaman. Can I go back to the Watchmen TV
Please,
show?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Now this is not a streaming series. This is on HBO.
Right. I happen to watch it on HBO Now streaming service, but you're right. It is on HBO.
It's not a streaming show.
Right. This is on HBO. And, so far just a quick note for those who, unlike Jim, have read Watchmen. It picks up 30 years after the events of Watchmen. It picks up initially with just a couple of the characters.
Of the comic book.
Of the graphic novel.
It's a comic book, yeah.
Well, it was originally released as 12 issues, so I would say it's a collected comic book, but yes.
Yes, so okay. It's a comic book.
Yeah, comic book. It picks up 30 years after. It is a very different type of story in focus, but it is intently similar in tone and structure. I think you can get everything out of it almost if you've never read the original comic books. But one of the things you have to keep in mind is a whole generation out there, many generations now, who read Watchmen as a graphic novel. So, basically got the whole, sat down and could read the whole story straight through.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take a year to get from issue one to issue 12 like it took me in. When it came out.
Right.
So, yes, the pacing of this models the pacing of the comic book release not the graphic collection.
But this is a totally different story.
Is a completely different story.
And one that Alan Moore has yet again disavowed.
Yes, that is absolutely correct.
But one can't blame him. After all the dreck that has been produced in his name.
Well, he has one very, very compelling point. If they think I'm such a great writer, why don't they ever hire me to write the script? I get that the talents might not carry over, but he says after the third group of people come to you and spend an hour telling you what a great writer and then tell you who they're going to ask to write for them, it gets on your nerves.
I think that he has a point. But having said that, philosophically, I think he should probably talk to Chris Claremont, who has seen a lot of bad versions. Frankly, I have to talk to Chris about it. I see Chris at least once or twice a year, but I have not seen him since Dark Phoenix came out. And that's one movie I haven't seen, probably because I like Chris so much.
There you go. But the thing is...
Did you see it?
No. Okay. I saw it when it was called X-Men 3.
Yeah, well, they're telling the same story.
I know.
That is covered in X-Men 3.
We
do have to explain to audiences.
Yes. Right.
It's a broadcast. But.
Right. But basically, if you accept that what you're getting in the Watchmen TV show is one issue at a time, structured almost exactly following the structure of the Watchmen original Watchmen comic books, that you're not being handed a whole graphic novel in one chunk that you can just sit down and read. Once you accept that, then this show is wonderful.
Yeah. Dan Person says, Alan Moore has refused to even be credited on the series.
Oh, that's correct. It's actually kind of fun to see the co-creator credit co-created by Dave Gibbons, but without ever saying who the other person was. And he has every right to do it. And, you know, God love him, he's turned down a heck of a lot of money to have his name pulled off this,
wow,
this stuff.
Yeah.
He's walked away from millions.
Yeah. And
so...
to quote the title of another movie, take the money and run.
Well, he could have chosen to do that. He did not. And at least he's literally put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah.
He's saying,
well, he's also an eccentric.
To put it lightly, yes.
You know, as a person, he is an eccentric.
Right.
So I think we will leave it at that. But yeah, having said that, yes, I have seen nothing but decent reviews, actually, including the New York Times. Of the HBO series. But here's the problem, is that there's only so much money that one can devote to one's services. And it's getting very difficult. The disadvantage of cable TV was a huge sum of money so that you can get all these channels you never wanted. I don't know anybody who's ever watched a show on ESPN in their lives. You know, why? Tiddlywinks? I once, when I was in some restaurant, they had on a women's softball game. And that turned out to be ESPN. And I thought, actually, that was rather cool. I enjoyed seeing that. But I wouldn't subscribe for that reason. But you pay this incredible amount. Now, it's easy to, quote, cut the cord, which I did about a year and a half ago with one of the better services out there, which to me the first qualification was that at the time was the only service that had Turner Classic Movies. And if something doesn't have Turner Classic Movies, then I'm not interested. Fortunately, now most of them do. There aren't that many yet, but there's the confusingly titled YouTube TV. There's DirecTV, which I think is now, I get very confused about this part of AT&T TV. I think they merged. It's AT&T Direct, and they're changing their name, Erlong. coming up soon will be Warner Brothers, which is going to be called HBO Max. And they will be taking all of their toys and putting them in one basket in exactly the same way Disney has done with Disney Plus. And by the time, and Netflix is sort of a given, although Netflix is no longer an archive. One of the things that I loved was the idea of having an archive of things that you could go to and watch, you know, your old favorite shows, and some of them just aren't there. Prime Video does a reasonable job of this, and it has the advantage of, if you are a Prime member, it's a free service.
The if I can. Okay.
And let me name, I was going to name two others.
Go on. Yeah.
Well, too late, I've forgotten what they were.
What I find both great and irritating about the multiple streaming services is that they seem to be competing with each other to produce at least one extremely high-quality show.
Right. Oh, I was going to say one more thing. The one service, which I don't care to subscribe to, that does have a lot of archival stuff, is Hulu.
Okay.
And part of the problem was it was co-owned by Fox, but now that part of Fox is part of Disney. But again, I don't want to subscribe to 40 services. Okay, now go ahead.
Okay, well, as I was saying, Mike, it's great that all of them seem to be competing to produce one amazingly high-quality show. But it means if you want to watch all the amazing high-quality shows, then you have to subscribe to lots and lots of different types of services. Now, I don't see this lasting forever. Eventually,
something will shake out.
Eventually, they will sell packages of services will be sold.
Yes.
And we will basically wind up back in a system that it's similar to what cable was. It just has a different way of getting to your house. But at least, especially in the genres that I like that are off base from the mainstream, it's nice that they're actually putting all this effort into it's sort of like, as a creative consultant, which I also am among the many other things, there are times when I just want to shout at a client, what if you told better stories? It's not that you need have the wrong gimmick. It's not that you're focused on the wrong demographic. It's not all that. It's that your story isn't very good.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, finally people are listening. They're saying, what's the best way to attract people to our service? Give them a really good story. And I have to decide whether I'm willing to pay for this one show and then hope other stuff I like pops up.
Yes. Oh, by the way, at least one person became a BAI buddy during the show, a Benjamin Zuhl, who's a good friend, I have to say.
Yes.
And it says, thank on air. Yes. Yes. Thanks, Ben.
Okay.
So we need a few more people to do that, by the way, by calling 516-620-3602 or going to the WBAI.org website. Sorry, go on, but we do have to pitch. By the way, if we're going to play that thing we discussed, we have 3 minutes.
Okay, then let's talk about me.
Okay, fine. So we'll put that off for another show.
Okay.
It's really too bad. We were going to play a Poison Darts episode, but it runs 34 minutes. But I need to find digital versions of the episodes known as the Poison Darts Minutes, which was after Poison Darts was on the air for years. We were able to get our then arts director, Matthew Finch, to agree. We used to have miscellaneous 5-minute slots that would take up the slack of shows that ran over. And if they didn't, we could squeeze 3 minutes of programming in there. So the so-called Poison Darts Minute ran about 3 minutes long. And there are whole bunches of episodes, and they were fun. And each week would be an entire arc. I think there were 4 episodes a week. And there was a particularly fun one, which featured... Well, I was in quite a few, just as one character that had one line all the time, because that's why was the line. And we did a week's worth of episodes with Rene Aubergenois, who was associated with Janet and David when they were all young comic actors in Chicago. And that was a lot of fun. And I don't need to repeat the stories. DS9 was just premiering on TV at the time that we were there. He had finished shooting the first season, so he was actually on vacation and getting ready to do his first Star Trek convention, and he did not know what that entailed. It's a great story. I won't tell it again now, but...
Speaking of which, on the new upcoming Star Trek Picard show, one of the characters is played by Michelle Hurd, who I happen to have gone to school with for 10 years.
Oh, cool. Do you know anything positive or negative about that?
I've seen only what... I've seen just in the trailers. It looks good. So, but that's
about, yeah. But they're trailers.
I understand, but that I have no other information, and I'm too much a professional to even ask her. But when she got the,
I've got no problems asking an actor. Are you enjoying the show?
Yes. She's having that. I've asked, and she's having a blast.
Yeah,
literally. But no, when I heard she'd gotten this role...
Okay, if you're going to say she's having a blast, I'll say it's just a phase.
Yes, yeah, okay.
Through. Okay, but...
Anyway, I said, "What? I just heard that you're on Star Trek Picard. Is this true?" Because for years I'd been nagging her, "You got to get on a show that'll get you an action figure." And I said, "Is it true?" And she said, "Yes, it is." And I said, "You've got your action figure show at long last." And she said, "Yes." And... I said, "Listen, I know this is all very new to you. If you need a native guide through the Star Trek fan universe, I'm here for you."
There you go.
And I actually texted her at one point while she was at her first Comic-Con promoting Star Trek Picard. And I somehow just randomly caught her there. She said, "This is insane." And it's like, "Yes, it is."
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But she is having a blast.
Yeah.
And
well, Rene was, he was at one of the New York conventions at the, Pennsylvania Hotel.
Right.
And, I think it had gone back from Statler Hilton to the Pennsylvania at the time. And he did not know what he was in for. I had something to hand him, and I said, "You know, when can I do this?" He said, "Oh, I'll be at a Star Trek convention. See me then." I said, "Okay, you'll get me in somehow." He said, "Oh, it's like, you know, just let the people know I'm there and I'll come down to the lobby and meet you." It doesn't work that way. you're going to be a little bit overcome by what's going on there. And he said, "Oh, listen, I did Benson for 8 years and I couldn't get arrested, walking down the street." So, and that is actually a direct quote.
Yeah.
And I said, "No, this is Star Trek." And so a month later, you know, the event happens. I go there and I find the Klingons, who are, of course, the security force.
Of course.
And I said, I have an appointment to see Rene Aubergenois. And they said, "Oh, yeah, who are you?" I give my name. They say, "Oh, yeah, he's here." And I get marched, you know, through back ways into the kitchen, and Rene is there. And he was like, "My God." I said, "I did warn you. What happened?" He said, "I get out on stage, and somebody asks me, if you change into a briefcase, what happens to the rest of your mass? Does the briefcase weigh as much as you do?" And I said, "And what did you say?" He said, the answer I gave was, "I don't know. Ask my agent." you know, which is, you know, that's what, that's right. This is the relationship to an actor. And, like, the next time I saw him, well, it was like a year later. It's not like we're friends or anything, but I've run into him those few times. And I asked him about it, and he was like, oh, I'm doing a cruise next week and this and that. He acclimated real fast. He enjoyed the limelight. And damn it, after all those Robert Altman films and everything else he did, he deserves that fame. He deserves just watch him in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, a movie that was on TV tonight, in fact, on TCM. Superb actor, wonderful actor, and I'm glad that he finally found his place in the sun. Suns, yes, but they don't necessarily fully get that. Let's talk a little bit. We have half an hour left, and we also do want to remind people to call and pledge. But you got me involved in background acting indirectly. There was what was the name of the first person in fandom who got involved?
Well, I don't know if he was the first person in fandom to get involved, but Stephen Rosenhaus.
It was Stephen Rosenhaus, and he, in turn, got Nicholas Kaufman into this whole thing, which then got you.
No. Steve came to me, and then Steve and I both harassed Nicholas.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Whatever. And that, in turn, got my partner, Barbara, into a show that you had already been working on. Or actually, I think she worked first, and then you worked on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. But she did, like, two episodes. And then you, before we get to what you did, I got involved briefly. I was in an episode of Billions, which I have not seen, so I don't know if I'm on camera or not. But I was also in episode 2 of The Loudest Voice, starring Russell Crowe and Seth MacFarlane, where I got to work for 3 days. And it was really, that was intense. The Billions thing was an outdoor shoot, and just one scene, very repetitive. There were helicopters involved and cranes and stuff like that. But to the people on the ground, to the extras, there was nothing to it. But to be on the set for The Loudest Voice, directed by the same woman who did The Handmaid's Tale and all that. Anyhow, if it's not even if you blink, you won't miss me. If you blink twice, you will. But I'm actually on camera for like 3 seconds, which is actually pretty long for a background actor. That's and I was directly next to Russell Crowe. Man, was he something? And I do have to tell a story quickly. While I'm on the set of this, I get a text from Barbara about a movie starring Naomi Watts that had just shown at the Sundance Film Festival. Now, Naomi Watts plays Gretchen Carlson in The Loudest Voice. The Loudest Voice is one of the two versions of the story of Roger Ailes. There's one in which he's Russell Crowe, and there's another in which he's John Lithgow. And in either way, there's a connection, because, of course, Lithgow used to work here at BAI. Russell Crowe, not so much with here, but the Naomi Watts thing. Now, she wasn't in any of the scenes that I was shooting. But there was a story from Film Threat about a new movie Naomi Watts had done, which is being released to wide release in the U.S., in 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, called The Wolf Hour. And according to the review in Film Threat, the story, it takes place in 1977 during the summer of Sam, about a woman who is very isolated, and it resembles to one extent Repulsion, the Roman Polanski film, and to another extent, a movie by Ingmar Bergman called Hour of the Wolf. And this radio show is named after that Ingmar Bergman film by Margot Adler. But why the title of the movie? Well, apparently, according to the review in Film Threat, the woman every morning wakes up at 5 a.m. to listen to Jim Freund, An Hour of the Wolf. I know no more than this. I have seen moments of the film, and as far as I can tell, because I've seen a scene in which Naomi Watts is sort of dancing wildly, listening to the radio, and at the end of this very weird thing, they say, that was the Wolf Hour, but there's never a mention of Hour of the Wolf, nor is there a mention of Jim Freund. I wonder if it was changed since it showed at Sundance. I don't know the story. I've reached out to the director, if I can do an interview with him, the writer-director, Alistair Banks Griffin, I believe his name is. But the coincidence being, she's a lead in this show in which I'm a background actor, and she's producing and starring in a film about me. And had she been there, I still wouldn't be allowed to go and talk to her.
Well, that kind of leads up to...
So, dialing back to The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Season 2.
Well,
when it was over, you weren't done.
Well, here's what happened. I went to The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel because Steve Rosenhausen called me and said, you have always
Steve
wanted...
Steve Rosenhausen is a science fiction writer, for those who don't know.
Right. And he said, you love Mrs. Maisel. You've always wanted to go to the Borscht Belt resort in the 1950s. They're filming a set in a resort in the 1950s thing. Here's who you get in touch with.
Get in touch with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And get in touch with them. And I did. And they pulled me in. And it's a slightly bolderized version of the story, but you're not supposed to talk to the main actors. But I'm in this scene, and Kevin Pollak is the father-in-law, and he is in the scene, but there's lots of camera changes, and he's getting very bored. So he started as a stand-up comic. So he...
I knew him first, actually, as a mimic.
Well, there you go. As a stand-up comic.
And a very good one.
As a stand-up comic. And, so he was basically doing shtick for entertain the background people and himself. He was doing his routine, and he was picking on people in the audience. And he picked on me. And the rule is you can't talk to the stars.
But they can talk to you.
Unless they talk to you. But in this case, it was iffy. But in any case, I stood up to my full height and crossed my arms. And he was picking on me. And I don't even remember what he said, but he was picking on me. And I said... This I gotta take from a guy who's 2 inches shorter than Milton Berle's Whoop. And this was a huge breach of decorum.
Yeah, and the word Whoop was not used.
Yes, exactly. And the
Whoopee would be a better phrase.
Milton Berle's Bing! And so...
No, that's a search engine.
Oh, okay, sorry. Keeps coming at me and are coming at me and everything. And Kevin has doubled over. And he says, no,
with
stop.
With laughter.
With laughter, yes. And he says, no, everybody stop. You know how long it's been since I've heard a good Milton Berle's ding joke? And that sort of got me the bug. Then I sort of decided, you know what? I'm going
to... All I have to say about his character is I really, really enjoy the series. And I really, really like Kevin Pollak. But his character in the show... is one of the great deficiencies of the show.
Well, I don't necessarily agree, but I'm talking about me. From there,
I just don't think he's well written.
Right.
Joel's family isn't well written.
From there, because I was still on the casting call list, I wound up auditioning and getting a role in the Carnegie Deli pop-up that was a promotion for Ms. Maisel.
Yeah, this is not a movie or anything.
This is a live recreation of the Carnegie Deli, which had closed.
Which people could actually go online for like, what, $1 sandwiches?
Free.
Oh, they were free.
Free.
They were advertising. They showed.
They advertised that. They did advertise a menu that showed 1958 prices.
Exactly.
But in fact, it was free.
Yeah. Because had they gotten the $1 or something, it would have cost them more to process.
Yes.
Receiving
that money.
And it
slowed everything down. Instead, we just asked for donations for a local girls club charity.
Okay.
In any case. So I was doing that, and I thought, you know,
a smart move.
I've never acted before in my life. Now I'm doing live interactive improv, 11 straight days in character as a 1958 pastrami maker, which came very easily to me, I must say. And I said, you know, I really like doing this comedy stuff. I should do more of it. I said, and you know, maybe if I actually got some training. So I went to I did UCB's improv. I did UCB's sketch writing. I got some sketches going off Broadway, and. Then I said, well, what's next in this comedy degree at the University of New York that I seem to be putting together? I said, well, stand-up is next. So found some great teachers, and I have been performing stand-up. I just came back from a tour of Kansas City, actually. Yeah, really.
Okay.
And I start at...
I was just looking for an in, like... No, I just rolled in from Kansas City, and boy, are my ribs hurting.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm fine, because I just got back from Kansas City, and somebody ate my ribs. But next week, I start my first pro run in New York at the Broadway Comedy Club.
Which is a major venue.
That sure as heck is. And I'll be there on November at the 9 o'clock show on November 26th, on December 2nd. And December 9th. And
how long is the set? Your set?
I'll be doing about 10 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 9 o'clock.
How long is an entire show?
You know, I'm not 100% clear on it because Monday night shows are not necessarily structured the same way as the weekend shows.
Ah, okay.
But there will be other comics besides me.
So this is a lower rung of a higher venue.
Well, the way I understand
it. Is that
right? Not quite. The way I understand it is that Friday and Saturday night sets are 20 minutes, but weekday sets are 5 to 10. And what they're doing is pretty much everyone else on the bill except me will be a known or named pro.
And I'll try.
I'm squeezed in to the middle of the mix.
Right.
Because I passed because I passed two levels of auditions.
Okay.
There and
now it's in front of a live audience. Yeah.
Well, they were always the auditions.
Oh, the auditions were live.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
But the reason I was trying to get you to come to a show, God help me, was that there are these in New York City as opposed to say Kansas City. The only way to get stage time is to do what's called bringer shows, which is you get your stage time in return for bringing a certain number of people with you.
Yeah.
Of selling it. Basically, you have to sell tickets. And they can go as high as 7 people or as low as 1. Tonight, it was just 1.
Right.
But Janine Garofalo was the opener.
And I'm sorry I missed her.
Yes.
I didn't get to go, and it was better that way. I prefer not to do things before having to go on the air.
Right.
Because even if it would be with you and all that, I still want to be focused. Not on the show itself, but it's just...
I understand completely.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I have real friends. No, fortunately, I got other people to go. And so...
And there was too much time from the show ending before this show starting.
Yes.
And I did nap in that time.
No, I'm... Frankly, Jim, I think if I had said, I have no one else, I desperately need you, you would have showed up.
Oh, I was all ready to show up.
Right.
And you said you found somebody else. I thought, okay, it'll work differently.
Right. And all in all, I'd rather you come to one of my pro shows.
And, actually, given the number of dates, I may very well do just that.
Right. And then these pro show stuff actually... is also sort of an audition for the next tier where they would send me around to a number of clubs.
So it's a circuit.
The idea is...
It's like an old comedy circuit.
It's vaudeville.
Yes, well...
It's vaudeville. It's the old circuit.
It's the old circuit.
That, yeah.
That's what I said.
Yeah. And I'm actually talking to a producer. I wanted to put together a tour of the country called something like Laughs Begin at 50 or something like that. Basically, new jokes from old folks, or basically find the people who are semi-retired and start a tour of the country with them. With that includes me because it was my idea.
You've got to work something out with the word boomer in it.
Well, I was thinking about that. I was also thinking something like...
Tarara Boomer TA. I don't know.
We're a tour for the 6 o'clock show. We're the early bird specials.
Right.
Something like that. But, yeah, it's been... I gotta credit Steve Rosenhaus for doing all of this. She basically shifted my life in this direction, and I really appreciate that. And he keeps ducking responsibility for it, but I blame him nonetheless.
There you go. So my question when I was asking, not how long, just your set and your bit
right.
in there is 10 minutes and otherwise right. 20. My question is, if a person goes to a performance, pays their admission, and sees a show, how long does,
typically 90, 90 minutes.
Okay, that's what I was really asking.
Yeah, typically it's a 90-minute show. And it's whatever the cover price is and whatever the two drinks.
Who gets paid for it? Every penny. Anyway.
Yes, exactly. Why not? He earns it. So oddly, my life has shifted in this weird direction. I've only been doing it since February.
Yeah, but it's, not counting the Mrs. Maisel part.
Right. Well, the stand-up comedy?
No, the stand-up comedy, which is another phase in your showbiz career. But your showbiz career began, about 2 years ago? Is that right? A year and a half, 2 years ago?
No, I can't help myself. I've been trained.
It's a 1950s show.
I know.
Mrs. Maisel.
Yes.
They didn't do Midge. Enough with...
Let's just call him Midge.
Midge. Okay, fine. They didn't do enough with Lenny in the second series.
Yes. But I think it's been just over a year since I did Miss Maisel. It was second season Miss Maisel. It was like August or September.
I don't think so. I think it was broadcast about then. I mean, filming it. Remember how much time between filming it and it's going on the air. And the new series is going on the air in a few weeks. There was a lot of time for the Sherman Palladinos.
You may be more right about my life than I am. It's certainly possible. Well, I'll look it up.
Remember, Barbara was also an extra,
right?
In two episodes, and I might be wrong. You might be. It doesn't matter.
It really, honestly,
but
doesn't
your matter. Showbiz career is under 2 years old.
Definitely,
and it's a whole different phase. And it's an interesting thing. Do you think that has anything to do? Is there any connection in your personal self-esteem that this started happening after you lost an amazing amount of weight?
I think it might have related to that, but there's certainly. I've certainly found myself to the one...
P.S. John has a book about that.
Yes.
To show you can look it up. Well, yeah.
You can look it up.
It's Ordover, O-R-D-O-V-E-R.
Yes. I appreciate the intro. It's called Lie There and Lose Weight, How I Lost 100 Pounds by Doing Next to Nothing. It's on Amazon. By 20.
It's holiday season.
But right now, come see me do professional... stand-up comedy, to my immense pleasure and surprise.
No, I'm going to try to do it. I mean, and that won't be one that where you can get me in for free. The other ones you could have gotten me in for free,
right?
But not in this venue. I didn't ask.
Right,
I knew.
Yeah,
I knew.
It's an interesting new sideline in my creative. My lifetime of creative pursuits.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
It's interesting. It really is. And I have to see you because on the one hand, I know your personality and I know that you've always had a certain amount of in your personality. But to actually see you channel it in such a manner is something I look forward to.
It's interesting. It's clear what a seasoned professional I am because I just nodded into the microphone. But it is channeling it, is writing it. Here's what I like about it. I am, when I'm acting, I'm saying somebody else's words, which I may not think are as good as I could have done them.
Mm-hmm.
I could have written them. When I'm writing sketches for other people, I don't necessarily think the acting is living up to the brilliance of my writing. When I'm both writing it and performing it, I have no one to blame but myself.
There you go.
And I know that every word is written exactly the way I would write it.
So this is a form of self-mutilation, self-punishment.
Self-abuse.
There. That's it. Exactly.
It's a form of self-abuse.
Okay.
Yes.
I think it's time for another music break, because I need to take a break.
Okay.
And we're nearing the end of the show, and we can summarize shortly and then close out the show. But again, looking for a song that would have something to do with the comedy circuit and stuff like that. We'll do that, and we'll be back in 3 minutes.
You can pull all the stops out till they call the cops out. Grind your behind till you're banned. But you gotta get a gimmick if you want to get a hand. You can sacrifice your sacro working in the back row. Bump in a dump till you're dead. Kid, you gotta get a gimmick if you want to get ahead. That's how burlesque was born. So but I do it with a heart. Revolution in dance. You gotta have a gimmick if you wanna have a chance. She can, she can, she can. They'll never make her rich. Me, I but I do it with a switch.
What a number. Best number in Gypsy. You know, forget all that let me entertain you stuff. It applies to stand-up comedy because they thought they were going into a vaudeville house,
right,
and it turns out to be burlesque.
Exactly.
It's the turning point in that story. By the way, if anybody, this is really, really, really hard to find. But if you want to see the best production of Gypsy that I have ever seen, there was a BBC version that I think was on PBS once, starring, of all people, Imelda Staunton, who I had not realized is quite the musical star, aside from being a major actress, of course. And Peter Davison playing Herbie. Yeah. And he's very good in it, although the one song he gets, yeah, sorry, Doctor, not his forte, but it's only one song. But really great production. I was astonished. I had no idea. But she's done Sweeney Todd. She's done a lot of Sondheim. And Gypsy, people don't think of it as Sondheim. But it is. He wrote the lyrics.
I just found out today that Stephen Sondheim and Tom Lehrer went to the same summer camp and knew each other.
Why am I not shocked by that?
I'm not at all.
Yeah.
But it was amusing.
Sondheim's godfather, of course, was Oscar Hammerstein.
Right.
And a lovely trivia point. And to get seasoning, they sent Sondheim out to Hollywood to learn how to write. And Sondheim wrote about three episodes of the TV series Topper.
Oh, I remember Topper.
Yeah, but did you realize that Sondheim wrote some of those?
No.
That's bizarre.
No.
That's just plain bizarre. Should we try to sneak in? Yeah, let's try one. Good morning, you're on the radio. Okay, it's not. It's a phantom call. We've been getting a lot of these on this phone line. And I don't know if it's going to be any different in the news studio. They tell us we'll be in the news studio next week. They told me that last week. So we shall see. We shall see. The news studio's nicer than this studio, but this studio has, well, no, I can't say it's got lots of charm.
It does. It does since I'm here.
There you go.
And it'll walk out the door with me.
Yeah. So, takeaways. Yeah, it's really, really hard. I would love to be able to do a focused program on where we are going with all these services. You and I focused on The Mandalorian. There's a lot of other really interesting stuff on Disney Plus to begin with. I really recommend the Nat Geo program starring Jeff Goldblum, which...
Isn't it some name like Jeff Goldblum hosts this show or something?
It's who cares?
Yeah.
It's a show with Jeff Goldblum. His name is in the title.
There you go.
And the first episode was Sneakers. The second episode was Ice Cream. And he is so natural a host. It really, really works. I think I would make some changes in the structure, but it's a lot of fun.
I assume that despite Thor Ragnarok, he does not make his guests battle to the death.
You know, he does, actually.
Oh, okay, good.
That's, yeah, I mean, he visits Ben and Jerry's, and now it's just...
Jerry's.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. no, he doesn't. And some of it, frankly, goes a little bit too far with setups and things like that. But I'm sure it will age well. But it's thoroughly entertaining. And I have to say, I like that new service, and I'm totally frightened of what it portends. Because there's only so much room. I was trying to express this earlier and ran out of time, and the same thing is, we're already out of time here, but the same problem exists and will continue to exist. Just how far can people go with all of these? We're moving from these banquets that nobody can afford to a la carte specials with a lot of fine specialties, but as you said, there's one good thing that you may find worthwhile on each of these, and you can't afford, I can't afford CBS just to watch Star Trek or Twilight Zone or Picard, even though that's three whole shows. And when Peacock launches, that's a great name for an NBC network, and it will be called Peacock. I won't be able to do that. I have the ones laid out. And my arbitrary network is one called Acorn, which I really like.
Watch Murdoch Mysteries. It's wonderful.
I've tried it. That's another conversation. We'll discuss it in the car.
Okay.
But I really, really, really enjoyed the original episodes. And then when it got into a thing later. But on Acorn right now, I recommend Murder Kills Me, or something like that. It stars Lucy Lawless as a detective.
Oh, yes. I've watched that one, too.
Yeah, and it's fun. And also, the sequel to Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries are Ms. Fisher's Mod Mysteries. And it's quite good.
My Life is Murder.
That's the name of it. Thank you. That's the name of it. And the first two episodes were sort of like, hey, I like watching her, and my God, does she look good at this point. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the series itself started getting real good. Don't know why, but that's okay. At any rate, John, why don't you tell people what's where again, when and where will you be?
I'll be at the Broadway Comedy Club November 26th, December 2nd, and December 9th.
Do at the 9 make p.m. reservations, show. Or do you just line up?
I'll go online, look up the club, and make reservations.
Broadway Comedy Club.
Yep.
Which is a major venue. Not quite as well known as the Cellar.
Right.
But it was better known before the Cellar found its place and sort of stayed steady.
Yep.
So thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I think I will be back next week. We're thawing, so it's an on-off proposition. Going to be changing up December from the way it's usually done on this show in the near future. We'll do Council of Elrond more likely in January. December, ghost stories, an old Dickensian tradition. Again, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn with Lister, coming your way in just a couple of minutes. In the meantime, be good to each other and enjoy. Well, Lister isn't in the room yet, and I've closed all of my resources that would offer us music. Let me find... Oh, here's some nice Peter Schickley music that we will enjoy, taken from Silent Running.
And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the red, white, and blue spit on you.
Expressing myself, torching the symbol. No repression, let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it while I'm going off berserk. Cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they still have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. Wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison? Cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Flag. I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what?
Cinco. WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, right here. Burn, baby, burn. Your weekend begins right about now. Yeah. Burn, baby, burn. Yep. Every Thursday at this time, you're going to hear all the music. All the music they refuse to play on Imperialist Radio right here. 99 Cinco, dedicating the entire show to Carl Anthony.
And this you see, it's gonna come.
It's gonna come, it's gonna come.
And when it comes, we have big fun.
We have big fun, we have big fun.
One love vibration.
You know.